changes are coming to our utility bills, plus how Miami landed a little piece of very important history. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. State officials voted yesterday to give utility companies the ability to put our power lines underground. This is supposed to harden them against storms, but it comes at an extra cost. Also, this week marks the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. We spoke with the German consul in Miami about the piece of that wall that now stands in downtown. And a new report now shows us that the number of children who are uninsured is going up, especially in South Florida. We'll find out why. Also, a recap of yesterday's elections. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Yesterday, voters throughout Miami-Dade went to the ballot box to cast votes in numerous city elections. Now, we're going to get to those results in the next 10 minutes or so, but first we need to update you on some changes that are happening to your utilities. Yesterday, Florida's Public Service Commission announced new rules that allow utility companies like Florida Power & Light to charge customers for the cost to underground power lines. Now, that cost is projected to be between $3 to $4 billion over the next 3 years, but it could balloon up to $50 billion over the next few decades. The PSC also rejected a proposal that would scrap the state's energy efficiency program. In place since the 1980s, this program has encouraged customers to save on their energy usage. The Miami Herald's Mary Ellen Kloss joins us from Tallahassee. She was at yesterday's commission votes. Mary Ellen, always a pleasure.
Hi, good to hear from you.
There were two key votes yesterday. Let's break them down. Let's start with the measure for storm hardening. Prior to yesterday's vote, how were utility companies reimbursed for storm hardening measures like, again, putting lines underground?
Well, ever since the hurricanes of, a decade or 15 years ago, Hurricane Wilma and others, the state's really been focused on trying to strengthen its grid in the wake of these hurricanes. But it's extremely expensive. So the utility companies have had to go to the state regulators and ask them to approve the cost and then put it into the base rate, into the rate that customers pay. So it was a pretty lengthy process, and it resulted in kind of a slow-moving progress in getting underground power lines buried across the state. So they wanted to find a way to accelerate that.
Governor Ron DeSantis signed into law last session the changes to rate review processes. Please help me understand SB 796. How does it work?
Well, it allows a separate charge outside of the utility's base rates now to pay for these undergrounding power lines. And it does it in a way that really does make it move more quickly. It allows the utility companies to collect money from customers to pay for this. It moves through a process that doesn't require as much scrutiny at the Public Service Commission. So they yesterday adopted the rules that will sort of put in place how this process will work.
And this is one of the arguments from consumer advocates. They're worried that because now the process could be quicker and you don't have to have as much of that, as you said, scrutiny, they're worried that customers might be, for example, double billed, right? How would that happen?
Right. So because of the rules that were put in place, the Office of Public Counsel, which represents the public in rate cases, and some of the largest users of electricity in the state, were really opposed to the fact that the Public Service Commission is not going to ask for the level of detail. So it is possible that big companies could potentially, they claim, bundle projects together and make it appear as if it is for transmission line underground or hardening or under burying power lines, and without having to go through the kind of detail where the PSC could validate whether or not that was something that they're already being charged for in the existing base rate, or if they're going to be charged for it with a new project. It sort of was there was criticism that this was going to allow the utility companies to kind of get away with more than they should be.
So when can customers expect to see a change in their utility bills?
Well, it looks as though it's going to still be a little while before we actually see that line item charge on the utility bills. But certainly, as possibly as soon as next year, we will start to see it. Now, the interesting thing, I think, is that we haven't really seen them come up with any when they've been pushing this through the legislative process. Nobody wanted to talk about what the price tag is going to look like. But when they're talking to their shareholders, they have indicated what that will be. And that's why we've gotten estimates that in the next 3 years, it could be as much as $3 to $4 billion just for Florida Power and Light alone. Now, one of the things this bill does do is it requires the utility companies to have a 3-year plan and have that be approved. So every 3 years, we're going to see them have to go back and get additional scrutiny.
So the utility companies, part of their argument, you sort of touched on this here, is that the underground power lines is this long-term investment that will benefit us, the customers, and of course reduce that time and we get our power back after, for example, a major storm or cleanup cost. What are some of the criticisms, though, about this, the putting the power lines underground? Is that really the most effective way to do things?
Well, that is one of the other criticisms of the way they developed this rule, is that they haven't really required the utilities to say, give us a reason for how you're making sure that this is the most efficient. There is this widespread understanding that it's, you know, after a hurricane, we need to get power up faster. And to do that, you know, it's easier if the power lines are underground. Except that there have been a lot of people raising concerns that in flood zone areas, places that are prone to storm surge, those waterlogged areas are not able to get back up after a hurricane quickly. And so is undergrounding really the answer there? And that the PSC hasn't really made any distinctions at this point as to whether or not they're going to you know, how they're going to decide whether the utilities are making the right call or not.
And is the plan to put the lines underground pretty much statewide or just in certain places?
That is something yet to be decided as well. We haven't seen a map as to where it's going to look like. It's pretty clear that they're already in the process of trying to get working on it. So there still are a few unanswered questions about this.
And, you know, we talked about when those charges are going to show up, but what are the charges? What can we expect, you know, is going to cost us?
You know, I think that is the million-dollar question here. We already know that we're paying something for the underground, the burying of power lines and the hardening of the grid that's happening already. But the question is, how much will this add to the average bill and how much in the past? It really is uncertain. And I think that because it's likely to mean that it's really going to raise the price significantly for some people, that's why they've avoided this putting a price tag on it. There were groups like AARP when the legislation was proposed who really question whether this is a good idea because people on fixed incomes, they fear, will have a harder time paying their bills.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Mary Ellen Kloss. Yesterday, board members for Florida's Public Utilities Commission voted on two new policies that could impact your bills and energy savings programs. And you can read more about this and her stories on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Let's take a look at the second vote. This was on the energy savings program. This was established back in the 1980s, state regulators rejected this plan by utility companies like FPL to scrap the program. First, let's remind ourselves of what that program was. How was it supposed to work?
Well, the idea was that back in the 1980s, when energy efficiency was becoming, you know, more of a current thing to be concerned about, the legislature tasked the Public Service Commission with setting goals. And basically it told electric utility companies, these are the goals that you need to meet to try and encourage your customers to save this much in energy savings. It's sort of a counterintuitive thing. Tell your customer to use less of your product. They also gave them incentives by allowing them to charge customers for it. And they provided, you know, programs that would be approved that would let them encourage people to buy energy efficient appliances, give rebates for that, buy, you know, lower, more efficient light bulbs, wrap water heaters, that kind of thing. Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, and it was popular because, I mean, there was a big response to this vote. The PSC said that they got like 2,000 letters from customers asking to keep the program in place.
Right, right. So, yeah, the public really does sort of think that the utilities should be focused on saving energy and not just asking them to pay for what they consume. So there was some pushback. And the problem with the program as it had evolved is this is not something the utilities, it was not one of their favorite programs. So as the Public Service Commission became, as the membership changed on the commission and became a little bit more inclined to favor the utilities' point of view, they watered down the energy standards. And they moved it to a point where they imposed things that were unevenly applied so that a homeowner who could afford a new low-cost or a new low-energy appliance could benefit from the savings, but a low-income person who could not do that wouldn't see any benefit. So they argued that this was really sort of unfair. And everybody was paying for it, but not everyone was benefiting from it. So they decided, since that is where we are, we should just scrap it and not use it at all. Well, that's when the pushback came, and the public said, no, we want to see some conservation standards.
Why did the utility companies oppose those the standards? And again, it's a fee that they were able to put on our bills.
Well, you know, it's because if you can encourage people to use more of your power, why not let that be the case? You know, their argument is that people already are doing things that are saving energy, so we don't need an extra program that on top of the fact that, you know, people are already buying energy efficient light bulbs. People are already, some people are actually putting solar panels on their homes. We don't need to be paying to encourage people to do it. They're going to do it voluntarily anyway.
And didn't they also argue that they felt it was just customers were subsidizing a small group of people who were doing it? Their argument was really only a few people are actually doing these things by putting in, you know, better conservation practices in their home. Wasn't that part of their argument too?
Yes. Yeah, that is. That's the argument, that the wealthy can afford these, but maybe somebody who's not so wealthy cannot. So that's unfair. And there's some subsidy going on. The argument by some of the proponents who wanted to retain the program is Florida doesn't have to use this program. They can do it. They can adopt programs like other states have that are designed to focus on encouraging the most programs that encourage everybody to use efficiency and then give the savings to everyone.
Right.
As opposed to just select who gets to benefit.
Tell me about Tampa Attorney Julie I. Brown. She was one of the key voices on this. Who is she? What was she? She was arguing to the PCS to not scrap the program.
Yeah. So she is a long-serving member of the Public Service Commission. This program gets reviewed every 5 years by the commission, and she was on the commission in 2014 when they approved a plan that watered it down. And so she's seen the history, and she basically said, we can't scrap this. This is something the public wants, and I don't believe it's in the public interest if we get rid of it. But she said, it does appear to be out of date. It's not responsive to how people operate right now, and so we need to update it. So she passed a resolution that said, let's just keep the standards we have approved in 2014 and see if we can update the law.
How does Florida's energy consumption compare to other states comparable in our size?
We're about in the middle. Comparable in our size, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I know. I know that's true.
Do you know?
No, I don't. But I mean, yeah. To say other states that are relatively big states.
Yeah, but we're not, certainly not near the top. In fact, the advocates say that we're closer to the bottom in energy conservation. And I don't think anybody would disagree that Florida's law has not kept pace and it needs some updating. That means then that you just need the legislature to redo it, and we'll see how that goes.
Environmental groups, they saw this as a victory?
Yeah, they saw it as a victory because this Public Service Commission has traditionally kind of sides with the utility. And the other thing is this, the PSC's staff, their professional staff, recommended scrapping or going to almost, not every utility would go to zero in terms of its energy goals. It might still have to do some things like energy audits and those kinds of things. But it was getting, the recommendation was to do away with most of it. But the problem is that this is state law, that the PSC is supposed to be encouraging utilities to save money or to save to provide a conservation goal and encourage customers to save energy. And there was nobody proposing an alternative. So there was some question if they'd scrapped it, whether that would have violated the law.
We've been talking with the Miami Herald's Mary Ellen Kloss, again talking about the meeting that will impact our utility bills come the future. And you can read more about it, by the way, on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Mary Ellen, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Good to talk with you, Liz. Thanks.
And again, that means our utility bills will be changing. Keep an eye on that. Now, it's time to turn over to our local elections here in Miami. Yesterday, voters went to the ballot box. Let's take a look at some of the races from yesterday in Miami. The City Commission had races for District 1 and 2. The District 1 seat will have a runoff between former State Senator Alex Diaz de la Portilla and auto parts retailer Miguel Angel Gabela. The runoff election is November 19th, by the way. In District 2, incumbent Ken Russell easily won his reelection, capturing 59% of the vote. Commissioner Russell will be joining us, by the way, on the program tomorrow. In Miami Beach, there were three commission seats that will go to runoff elections. In Group 4, former Commissioner Kristen Rosen Gonzalez awaits her opponent in a runoff since the next two candidates were very close. In Group 5, incumbent Ricky Areola will run off against Raquel Pacheco. And in Group 6 of Miami Beach, former state representative David Richardson will run off against Adrian Gonzalez. Now, voters in Miami Beach, by the way, had a number of referenda to choose from, and one of them was to expand the mayor's term from 2 to 4 years. They rejected that notion. They also rejected giving commissioners and the mayor a pay raise. There were races in Hialeah. Monica Perez, an elementary school teacher, won Group 1. The races in Group 2 and Group 3 are headed to runoff. Again, the runoff is November 19th. The winner of Group 4 is Oscar De La Rosa. And voters also rejected the referenda that gives the mayor the power to declare an emergency and temporarily suspend spending limits after that emergency. One more vote to look at real quickly. In Homestead, voters selected Stephen Losner as their new mayor. Sean Fletcher won Council Seat 2. Incumbent Larry Roth won Council Seat 3. We'll post these election results, by the way, at WLRN.org if you'd like to check them out. Again, as we mentioned, we are going to have Miami City Commissioner Ken Russell, who won his reelection, on the program tomorrow. Well, still to come, there's a new study that shows the number of children nationwide who are uninsured is growing. The numbers are particularly bad in South Florida. We'll find out why. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. More and more children in the U.S. may be missing out on basic health care because they're uninsured. Now, this comes from a new study by the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families. The report is called The Number of Uninsured Children is on the Rise, and it shows that in Florida specifically, there's been an 18% increase of uninsured children between 2016 and 2018. Now, one of the reasons cited for this problem was immigrant families' fear that signing up could lead to possible deportation or other ramifications under the current administration. Joan Alker is the executive director of the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown University and the lead author of this report. She joins us now via Skype. Ms. Alker, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this latest report is actually the ninth annual such report on the state of uninsured children in the U.S. Remind us of what launched Georgetown to keep track of these statistics in the first place.
Well, you know, this used to be a good news story for our country. For many years, we were making progress on reducing the number of uninsured children as a result of Medicaid expansions and the passage of the Children's Health Insurance Program. So by 2016, after the Affordable Care Act was implemented, the nation had reached an all-time low in the number of uninsured children. But unfortunately, during the first 2 years of the Trump administration, that number has started going in the wrong direction, both nationally and in the state of Florida.
So again, looking at the trend, since the signing of the ACA in 2010, you saw an uptick and then all of a sudden it dropped off?
No, actually, for children, we've been making progress for many years before the Affordable Care Act, because we had Medicaid expansions all the way back to the 1990s and the Children's Health Insurance Program. So the Affordable Care Act was really the cherry on the top of the sundae for kids. That brought down the rates to their lowest level ever in 2016. But as a country, we'd had bipartisan support for many years to make progress for kids, even before the Affordable Care Act.
So when we look at the report, I see numerous states that have seen this increase in uninsured children. And I mean, it looks like a lot of the states that had denied Medicaid expansion under the ACA. So is there a correlation?
There absolutely is. And what you see is that states like Florida that have not expanded Medicaid to parents and other adults saw an increase in their child uninsured rate that's three times as large as states that have. So we see a real gulf opening up here. And that's partly because when you cover parents and you offer new coverage, there's a lot of discussion about that. Families come in, realize that both parents and kids are eligible. But there are other factors at work here, and I want to highlight a couple of things that are especially important for Florida and South Florida. We believe this loss of coverage among children is really being driven by a loss of public coverage for kids, Medicaid and CHIP. And there are a couple of trends at work. First, because of the climate of hostility by the Trump administration towards immigrant families, particularly Latino families, there's a real fear out there of enrolling their kids, who in most cases are citizens, into Medicaid coverage, even though, and I want to be clear, it is safe. That is not one of the lists of benefits that would have somebody be declared a public charge. So it is safe to enroll your child in Medicaid, but there's an understandable fear in the community about doing that. So we did see nationally that uninsured rates went up, particularly for white children and Latino children, who of course can be of any race. And in Florida, we do see a jump in the number of Latino uninsured children who already had higher uninsured rates to begin with.
And when you look at Florida, you know, you look at that map of the different counties, and it shows Miami-Dade County the worst, one of the worst counties in the country when you talk about the increase of uninsured children.
That's right. Miami-Dade has 41,000 uninsured children. That is in the top 10 nationwide. And Florida overall has 339,000 uninsured children, ranking 50th in the country on that metric, unfortunately. One of the things that's really interesting, I do quite a bit of work in Florida in the South, and you may be surprised to hear that Florida actually has the worst rate of coverage for kids in the South, except for Georgia and Texas. Your neighbors to the north, like Alabama, Louisiana, even Mississippi, they're doing a better job. Alabama actually is doing a much better job. So this has been a problem for the state of Florida for many years. But now it's gotten even worse with these actions by the Trump administration.
And of course, this again is between 2016 and 2018, because I mean, we think about all the new arrivals that we've had in Florida just in this past 9-10 months. But I wanted to, if, as much as you could tell me, how you gathered this data, you know, for the study.
Yeah. So what we do is we use Census Bureau data that comes out every fall in September, and we analyze that data to look at how the U.S. is doing and how all 50 states plus D.C. are doing. So we've done this report for many years. And what really struck me this time, like I say, this used to be a good news report. But now we see, you know, virtually all states either going in the wrong direction or not making any progress. Only one state in the country, North Dakota, made progress. And that speaks to these national trials and tribulations that we're seeing. And not only do we have a climate of hostility that's causing what we call a chilling effect for immigrant communities, particularly Latino families, but we see states putting up more red tape, so that it's harder for families to learn about the coverage, to enroll their kids and keep that coverage. And Florida has a really complicated system of children's coverage, and that's something the state should work really at simplifying and making it easier. These families don't need more red tape. They need clear and accurate communication about how they can make sure their children get the health insurance they need.
I'm talking with Joan Alker. She's the executive director of the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown University. She's also the lead author of the report that looks at the growing rates of uninsured children in the U.S. That report is called The Number of Uninsured Children is on the Rise. Now, it found that in the state of Florida, there was an 18% increase in the number of uninsured children between 2016 and 2018. By the way, you can find a link to the full report on our Facebook or Twitter. Just look up WLRN Sundial. So, Ms. Alker, you talked about two things I want to get to, chilling effect and the red tape issue. And let's start with the chilling effect. Again, you cited in the report this idea. I wanted you to elaborate a little bit more. What exactly is the chilling effect?
The chilling effect is the consequence of the very harsh rhetoric and proposed policies by the Trump administration to crack down on immigrant families in a number of ways. There was a regulation which thankfully has been put on hold by the courts that would expand the ways in which immigrants trying to adjust their status could be deemed a public charge. Not to mention policies like family separation, increased deportation. And so all of those things have created a climate of fear in immigrant communities. And most of these children we're talking about are citizens, but they lived in what we call a mixed status family, where the parent is not a citizen. And that's where we are really seeing this chilling effect, that families are, in some cases, pulling their children out of Medicaid or Healthy Kids in Florida, or they're just not enrolling them in the first place.
In the end, it's just people are afraid to step out of the shadows. They're afraid that if they get exposed, it could mean deportation.
That's right. And this is a horrible choice for a parent. You know, no parent wants their child not to have health insurance. And, you know, fortunately, children are not very expensive to cover. Most of them are healthy, but they need that preventive and primary care. They need the immunizations. They need to get their asthma treated. So it's very short-sighted. We know that kids who have health insurance do better in school. They have better health outcomes. There are many, many benefits to making sure that kids have coverage. So we really need the country as a whole, and particularly in states like Florida, where we see this growth in the uninsured, to rededicate ourselves to let's turn this around. We know as a country we can improve, but now, sadly, we're going in the wrong direction, and we need to turn that around.
The other thing you mentioned was, of course, red tape. It's the application process, that this is also a hindrance. Can you elaborate on that, too?
Sure. So one of the other pieces is that there have been a lot of cuts by the Trump administration in outreach and enrollment, community-based navigators who can help families with the complicated application process. And in Florida, there are five, even potentially six ways that families have to consider for their children. It's a very complicated system in Florida, one of the most complicated in the country. So there's navigating that complex system. There's also a lot of families who may be losing coverage at renewal. States are cracking down on checking income, making families provide more pay stubs, and kicking families off if they don't return one letter, which may have gotten lost in the mail. So bottom line is, again, we need to simplify and streamline both the enrollment process and the renewal process so these kids can get covered and stay covered.
What's your biggest concern when you think about all of these children who go uninsured and thus they're not getting maybe the health care they need? What's your greatest concern about what's happening to them?
Well, two things. You know, first of all, we know that medical bills are one of the leading causes of family debt and even bankruptcy. And it's all too common for a child to have a fall on the playground, break a bone, wind up in the emergency room. That can set a family back for months or years. So there's economic consequences here. But of course, the child's health is also at stake, because we know that children, fortunately, don't wind up in the hospital that often, but they need their well child care. They need those interventions to make sure they're growing and thriving, and that easily controllable conditions like asthma are controlled so they don't wind up in the emergency room. So there really are a world of reasons why it makes good sense to make sure these kids have coverage.
And you think on a national scale, I mean, the long-term implications of a large portion of this younger generation not having health insurance, that, you know, just I'm thinking down the road, what that means for the nation.
That is a great point. You know, there's a lot of research that shows kids who had Medicaid health insurance as opposed to uninsured kids had higher graduation rates from high school. Even had higher rates of college attendance and had a better economic outcomes, which meant in the long term, they were using less government assistance and saving taxpayer dollars. So for the future of our country, again, it's very short-sighted not to make sure that all children have coverage.
What do you hope political leaders are going to take from this study? I wonder if you'd spoken to any of them in any state.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We've had just an amazing response. I think the public is really concerned about this issue. And, you know, I may have rose-colored glasses, but this really was an issue that had bipartisan support for so many years. And obviously, we're at a time of enormous conflict and partisan fighting in our country, especially about healthcare. So I hope that children is a way that we can get back to that bipartisan support that we've seen in the past. And, you know, I'm sort of cautiously optimistic that that might happen. But, of course, it's an election year. We will see. But that doesn't mean there aren't things that states could be doing. Governor DeSantis, Tallahassee, there are things states can do. Ultimately, we need a national and a state effort. But in the meantime, there are steps states can take.
And you think about, you know, obviously we're in an election cycle. And so you hear a lot of candidates with a lot of ideas. But is this about just, you know, making changes within the states, or is it about looking at our healthcare system overall and possibly having to change it?
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of ways to look at this. And the federal government absolutely could, first of all, even without passing any legislation, could dramatically change their attitude at the moment. They are not seemingly at all concerned about this problem. They're not monitoring closely what's going on in states. And of course, they're creating this chilling effect with all of the harsh policies towards immigrant families. So there's many things. But of course, you know, we could see Congress in the future move towards some new ideas about covering children, maybe cover all children 0 to 5 as a starting point, so that as soon as they are born in the hospital, then they're covered till they go to school. There are lots of policy options here that you can scale up or down.
We've been talking with Joan Alker, Executive Director of the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown University. Again, a new report they have out. It's their ninth annual report on this, looking at how many uninsured children there are in this country. That number is on the rise, and in Florida especially, here in Miami-Dade especially. Ms. Alker, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for your attention to the issue.
Absolutely. And again, we will have that report available to you on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, we're going to look back on the anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall and about the piece of that wall that's here in Miami. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. This Saturday marks the 30th anniversary of the collapse of the Berlin Wall. The destruction of the wall marked a key turning point in the U.S. Cold War and was an event followed around the globe. By the way, do you remember where you were? I do. A piece of that history is right here in Miami. Now, you'll find a segment of the wall covered in its original graffiti at Miami-Dade College Wolfson campus. Tomorrow, the college will honor the 30th anniversary with special events throughout the day. Students at MDC developed a virtual reality Berlin Wall app that allows viewers to see what the original wall looked like. And in the evening, the college opening of the exhibition, From the Peaceful Revolution to German Unification. Andreas Spiegel is the German consul based here in Miami. Spiegel grew up in West Berlin, just a half mile from the wall. And we spoke with him about the significance of the wall and how Miami got a piece of it. My understanding is you lived half a mile from the Berlin Wall while the city was still separated. Where were you exactly?
Well, I lived in my parents' house, which is indeed was about a half mile from the wall. We could see the wall at night. It was illuminated. From my kitchen window, I could see the wall. And I do remember actually the time before the wall was built, because I'm a little older than that. And I went with my grandfather to get some coal and firewood at a place which then was East Germany or East Berlin. And then when the wall was up, obviously that was no more possible, so we had to go to another place. So in my children's memory, I still have that this is a very present memory. What difference it did make that the wall was there.
Remind us of the tension that existed between the two sides when the wall was up.
Well, the tension was there, had been building up during the times of the Cold War when almost 3 million people from East Germany had actually migrated towards the West to find more economic well-being and so on. That meant at the time almost 20% of the population had left. And that was one of the main reasons why the East German government and the Russian, the Soviet Union at the time, had this idea of protecting themselves against the brain drain and to build up a wall.
The moment that it finally comes down, it finally came down, where were you?
When it came down, I was actually celebrating my first foreign posting as a diplomat. I was in Bonn, the then capital, and I had my sort of cocktail party to say bye-bye. And actually, my first assignment was in Boston in the U.S. So when the news sort of came through that something was happening in Berlin, unfortunately, the party didn't last very long. Everyone went home to see what happened. And it was a very curious dynamics in that evening because actually it's German unification and the fall of the wall is due to an accident, actually, by the speaker, the then speaker of the Politburo, who simply didn't read what he was supposed to say during a press conference. He just read the front page and not the back page. And that meant that he, when he was asked whether new travel regulations, when they would be in effect, go into effect, he said, well, as far as I can see, now, right now, immediately. And that's why so many people right now immediately went to the border control stations and asked the officials there to let them pass through the West. And it was also transmitted by West German media, and East Germans did watch West German media. So it's like today with Facebook almost, that it spread immediately.
It went viral.
Yes.
When they were taking the wall down, what was the process? I mean, they just started one place, started breaking it down, or was it just everywhere people were just starting to break it down?
Well, just immediately following this opening, that is on the 9th of November, 1989, and the 10th of November, people tried to sizzle and to hammer a little bit of small piece and to keep a souvenir and so on. But the official dismantling only began weeks later, because for a couple of weeks it was a state of uncertainty of what would actually happen in the follow-up. And actually the most symbolic opening was the opening of the Brandenburg Gate, you know, the big symbol of Berlin, in just before Christmas, 1989. So that was when really the official dismantling process started, and it lasted actually until 1991. So it was because it was a wall which covered an area of, I would say, well, 150 kilometers or so.
So you were working, as you said, in Boston with the German consulate there. This was in the 1990s.
Yes.
And I wondered, what were the steps in getting a piece? Because you got a piece of the wall to mm-hmm. Boston. What,
yes.
What did you have to do to get that to happen?
Well, actually, as this was an event which was given coverage worldwide, people were extremely interested. And because of the famous speech of John F. Kennedy in 1963, when he came to speak to about 400,000 people in front of the City Hall in Schöneberg with the famous phrase, "Ich bin ein Berliner," I am a Berliner, which was a very important emotional support for the Berliners at that time. And we had a request from the Kennedy Library in Boston to get a chunk of the wall. And then we did the liaison with German and Berlin administration to make that possible.
And as you've said, many pieces are all around the world. It was 5 years ago that pieces of that wall made their way to Miami. Why was Miami selected as one of the sites for something so historic?
Well, I think it's just, as always, it's due to personal initiatives of people who are interested. And in that case, I think Miami-Dade College, on the one hand, our then Consul General, were the key persons that actually arranged for that. And, knowing that, as we said before, that many other pieces were distributed in other parts of the United States. And why not Miami with a strong German population here?
So people have probably seen it, not known. Many people don't realize it is at the Miami-Dade College Wolfsonian campus. How would you describe the pieces that are there?
Well, it's like it used to be in the late 1980s, when the wall was painted also from the western side, at least, where with graffiti and so on. So that actually became popular after unification, and there's still an exhibit of, let's say, half a mile of pieces of the wall, which is called the East Side Gallery, which still gives you a lot of examples of what kind of graffiti and what kind of motives, and very artistic sometimes, are portrayed there. And the idea was simply to have one original, authentic piece put here with a little bit of a documentation around it to understand the background, how it came up, how it came down.
And there's, my understanding, a second site for pieces in Miami? It's not just that one.
Well, there's as far as I know, I haven't been there yet. There's a private initiative which actually brought two more pieces to Miami, the northern area, yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Andreas Siegel. He's the Consul General of the Republic of Germany based here in Miami. This year marks the 30th anniversary of the collapse of the Berlin Wall. Multiple pieces of the Berlin Wall are on public display in Miami, and you can see photos and find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. You know, we reflect on this critical time in Germany's history. It's interesting to note some of the parallels between the key political issues facing the country and the experiences we have here in South Florida. Describe the waves of immigration Germany experienced throughout the 20th century and how that compares to what we have always known and experienced here.
In Germany, we had a particular wave of refugees right after the Second World War. We had about 12 to 14 million, I believe, refugees coming from the formerly German territories east, that is now Poland and Russia, even the Kaliningrad area. They had to be integrated into the post-war society, which was sort of a difficult task. Then we had this East-West confrontation with the Warsaw Pact, NATO built up, and so on. And so that meant that many people in the East, in particular in East Germany, tried to get a better future in the West. And even before the building of the Berlin Wall, I think I mentioned it just earlier, we had about more than 3 million people from the GDR migrating towards the West.
What was the attitude, the general attitude of Germans when you talk about these migrations? How did they respond to that?
Well, in general, I think there was a very positive and responsible attitude, seeing the necessity to integrate these people who were often also linked through family ties and friends. So it's sort of a different type of migration than if you have totally different ethnic or religious groups coming.
Because, I mean, it parallels what we've seen in this country, you know, over many years, you know, having that influx of immigrants from Latin America and a lot of refugees. And, I mean, you know, we've had different policies and depends on who's president. But, I mean, is there something that we can learn from that experience that Germany just underwent?
The fact is, if you look back in history, everyone somewhere sometimes has been a migrant. If you look at the United States, it's one of the most typical migrant countries. Almost 20% of the U.S. population is German, of German descent, by the way, although that dates back a little bit further. Just to give you an example, I was stationed once in Malawi, southeastern Africa, just after the Mozambican civil war. Malawian population at that time was 10 million people. They had 2.5 million refugees from Mozambique in their country, administered by UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, in big camps going up to 200,000 people in one camp. But curiously enough, although that is an influx of 25% plus of your own population in a poor country, they managed to deal with that. And I think from a humanitarian point of view, that I think is an example we should have in mind when we are talking about migrants coming in today.
How are you going to remember and reflect on the 30 years since the collapse of the Berlin Wall when we get to the anniversary?
It's a very important event to remember, not only for Germany, but also in terms of German-American relations, because in our family, people talked also very much about the Berlin airlift in 1948-49. There was this blockade decided by the Soviets of all water and land access to West Berlin at the time. So all the food, all the fuel, etc., had to be transported by air. And that certainly has paved the way for the Berlin that we have today. And as a matter of fact, I wouldn't be here today probably if that hadn't happened.
That was Andreas Spiegel, the German consul based in Miami. This Saturday marks the 30th anniversary of the collapse of the Berlin Wall. And tomorrow at Miami-Dade College, there will be a series of events honoring the anniversary, including a virtual reality app developed by students. And you can find more information later today at WLRN.org. Also, share with us on social media, where were you when the Berlin Wall collapsed? What did the event mean to you? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Would love to hear your stories. Well, that is Sundial for this Wednesday, November 6th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandra Martinez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontaro is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka, and our technical supervisor, the man pushing the buttons, Peter J. Meritz. Our theme music, by the way, is from the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo. Find them online, gobalo.com. And always remember that this program is also a podcast. In case you want to listen on your own time, find WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. Well, coming up tomorrow on the show, tomorrow on the show, Miami City Commissioner Ken Russell will join us after his victory in District 2. We're going to discuss his priorities for the coming year and his plans to address the affordable housing crisis in the city. The Girl Scouts of Tropical Florida is celebrating its 97th anniversary with a special annual leadership luncheon next week. The CEO of the organization and a Girl Scout join us tomorrow to explain how that organization is continuing to attract girls and what's new with the group. And an exhibition in Coral Gables by young children from Guatemalan Mayan Center in Lake Worth. We'll hear from some of their stories and understand how the exhibition came together. Some fascinating work. By the way, don't forget, we got a book club. Find us on Facebook. Join us. Look up Sundial Book Club. We are reading Everything Inside by Edwige Dontecot for the month of November. If you have a question, by the way, for Edwige, email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org, or post your question on the Facebook group. We're going to be talking with her this week for a future air date. We'd love to share your questions with her. That's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.